Happy Wednesday and welcome back to another episode of Sheer Crime. I'm Kenzie.
And I'm Amy.
Today, we'll be covering an episode in the Netflix documentary Catching Killers on the Happy Face Killer. Tanya Bennett was a 23-year-old living in Portland, Oregon with her mother when she goes missing on the evening of January 21st, 1990. Her body was discovered the very next day in a wooded area near a mountain road. Investigators quickly set their eyes on the only suspect they had, a man named John Sosnovsky, after his elderly girlfriend Laverne Pavlinak fingers him for murder. Laverne takes investigators on a wild chase with story after story about what took place that night, eventually implicating herself as the person responsible for Tanya's death. Did investigators hit the jackpot, or was there something they had missed? We are back!
Oh my gosh. We literally forgot how to even do this.
I know. This took us a while to get started here.
It took us way too long to get started. And then we were all ready and we're like, fuck, we forgot to do this.
Oh my gosh, I can't believe we're here again. This is wonderful. So great.
I haven't said fuck being recorded in a really long time. It feels great.
It feels natural.
Yes.
This is good.
This is good stuff. Good stuff, you guys. Well, we hope you didn't miss us too much, but we also do kind of hope you missed us.
Yes. I think they all did. Yeah. I was seeing some people saying stuff online.
Yeah.
They missed hearing us. I know. Our voices are so soothing. Soothing. The microphone.
Yes. ASMR.
Yes. So we are doing a new documentary series, Catching Killers.
Right. We have not done this one before.
We have
this
not.
This one's on Netflix.
It is on Netflix.
Which, like, everybody has.
Yeah, yeah. And this one, in particular, is a two-part episode. But they were really short.
Super
they were,
short.
Like, half hour each.
Yeah.
We're just going to do them all in one part for you guys, just to make it easier.
Well, yeah. Because, honestly, I mean, otherwise, our episode would have been pretty short. And who wants to wait?
Right. I agree.
For a two-parter.
I agree. Now, today, I brought us... Truly's watermelon and kiwi flavor.
Your favorite.
I really think that I'm going to hate this. I don't know how much I'm going to actually drink, you guys, to be completely honest. Watermelon, especially artificially flavored watermelon, is like the worst thing to me.
Yeah.
It's awful. I can't stand it. I don't even really like watermelon, like actual watermelon that much. It's very strange. I don't know.
It's
like it that much.
So good.
But they don't taste the same. A watermelon and artificially flavored watermelon don't taste the same to me.
Okay,
I
feel that way about grape. Like, no, this does not taste like grape. This tastes like purple.
Yes. Does purple have a flavor?
Purple has a flavor and it's artificial grape.
Yes.
Because who bit into a grape and said, that's what this tastes
right,
like?
Right, I agree.
Because it doesn't.
I've never thought about that before. And so true.
Yeah, it's a so color. True.
Now, should we pop our tops?
We should pop our tops.
Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Let's do it.
Set, go.
Oh, the watermelon.
No, that hit me.
It hit the nostrils instantaneously.
You're sniffing it.
I just know I'm not going to like this. Nope. It's exactly how I thought it would taste.
Yeah, it's supposed to be watermelon kiwi. There's not... What is kiwi? Kiwi has a very distinct flavor.
It does.
In real life.
Yes.
Kiwi, artificially, what is that flavor?
Yeah. I don't know. That... The watermelon completely takes over in this, and it kind of reminds me of those bubblegum suckers. The watermelon flavor on those... what are they called?
Are you talking about...
Blow Pops?
Blow Pops?
Yeah. The watermelon flavor sucker. That is what that tastes like. Ugh. I might still drink it, but it's not great. Just because I don't like watermelon. So, there's that.
I guess I kind of have that aftertaste.
That's all I taste, is that sucker.
Yeah. I have a big old piece of hair stuck to this entire can.
How do you like it?
It's not bad. It's not great. I wouldn't want multiple.
No.
But
no.
Let me just tell you, I just started a new job.
Yes, you did.
It has been a fucking weird, like, last couple weeks.
I'm sure.
I have been waiting to drink with somebody.
Yeah. It's been too long.
Since our last episode.
The drink is needed at this point.
The drink is needed. And it's been a week where I'm done. So yes. This is, it could honestly taste like warm dog shit. And I think I'd still drink it at this point. And be happy.
Because there's alcohol in it,
because
right?
There's alcohol in it.
All right. Well, cheers to that.
Well, cheers to it. It is better than warm dog shit, though.
Okay. I will agree with you.
At least it's cold.
It is cold. I don't know how it stayed cold,
dude,
this
when you handed it to me, I was honestly kind of surprised because I was like, this is going to be rough.
This was not in the fridge. It's been out of the fridge now for...
like 2.5 hours?
2.5 at least. At least. Probably 3 hours. Still ice cold.
Because we got to chatting. We had to catch up.
We did. It's been way too long. There's been so much that happened. I haven't seen you. Well, I saw you at the grocery store. We ran into each other at the grocery store. But before that, I hadn't seen you for...
6 weeks, maybe?
Easily 6 weeks. Yeah. 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 It's been a long time.
It's been a really long time.
Crazy. Well, we're back. I'm excited to record. This is a great episode, too.
It was pretty good.
I didn't know how it was going to end.
I didn't either.
It's very, very interesting. I didn't look it up either. I did not look it up prior to, get the answer beforehand. I was like, okay, I just want this to play out, and I want to see what actually happens. And it is nuts.
Yeah.
So, Amy, if you want to go ahead and start us off this week.
I shall do that. All right. So, like we said, this is a two-parter, but we're just going to fly through them as if there is no ending to
Correct.
The first.
Correct.
Yeah. So, what we get... prior to the credits starting, is we get a flash on the screen telling us that we're in Columbia Gorge, Oregon in 1990. We meet Detective John Ingram, and he's explaining to us that he began his career for the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office in Portland back in June of 1969. So he's been doing this for a while. He said that he ended up in the homicide division. And he tells us that, you know, you always hear about the suspect, but the victim is usually forgotten or like overshadowed right. in those situations. And the police become their voice. So that's why he wanted to become an officer in the homicide division. Now, this particular morning at the crime scene, he says the biggest issue had been identifying this victim that they found. There was no identification on her, so a sketch of her face was made and it was circulated throughout news media. When he describes this, I mean, it was pretty gruesome, right? So he says that on this January morning, it was easy to see the victim's body from the road. So she was not hidden very well.
Oh, that's so terrifying.
I know. He says that, and I thought this was funny, not funny, because we've mentioned it before, that he would equate it to looking at a mannequin because it looked so ghostly and so, like, unnatural.
Oh my gosh. Well, and rigor mortis sets in quickly.
Right.
And you look hard, like a mannequin. You know what I mean? Like, you don't look like a human anymore. And it's just, it's so, so sad. But this person was just dumped and wasn't even hidden. They weren't even, like, trying to hide her.
Right.
Oh.
Again, people, get a shovel. Take a moment to dig a fucking grave.
Oh, we don't want to tell people that.
Oh yeah, that's right.
We don't condone murder.
No. That's right. What am I thinking? This is not a how-to guide, you guys. No. Not a how-to guide. So they find this body. There's a rope around her neck, and they immediately are like, okay, this is obviously homicide and potentially a sex crime too. They notice that her jeans had been pulled down below her knees, and a section of the jeans in the fly area had been removed. And Detective Ingram was like, that's kind of weird. I've never seen that before.
That's a strange detail.
Yeah, and he says this must have been a very sick individual to have collected a trophy like that. I mean, you hear about, you know, killers taking, let's say, earrings or, you know, ID cards. We've heard about that. These types of, like, random things. But, like, to cut off a piece of jeans from somebody, you know, that's kind of weird.
Right.
Now, he says that about a week after that, there was this sketch put out, and circulated, and he was contacted by a woman who thought the woman in the sketch could possibly be her daughter. Oh, could you imagine?
I can't imagine that phone call.
No.
Looking.
Could you imagine being the mom seeing that and being like.
No. On the news, you see a sketch. And, you know, for the most part, the sketches aren't typically like spot on. They're just like a rough, you know.
But in this case, they had her face. So they knew what she looked like.
Yeah.
It wasn't somebody telling them.
The thought of like, oh my God, I haven't seen my daughter in the last few days.
Yeah.
And this definitely looks like her. It's like, oh my God, your heart would just sink.
Oh, 100%.
I can't even imagine making that phone call.
No.
And then having to go and identify. Oh no.
No. They said that a relative goes down to the medical examiner's office and positively identifies this woman as being Tanya Bennett. Now, Tanya was 23 years old and lived with her mother in Northeast Portland. She was said to be a wonderful and loving person around her family, but that she also enjoyed the bar scene and partying, which, I mean, at 23, I don't feel like that's weird.
No, that's very typical.
They said that she would frequently meet people at bars, and then it would be not weird for her to go spend a night or two with them. Again, I mean, it's not totally outside of what I've, you know, heard, but it's also kind of risky.
Yes. As a mother, I would just be worried. If this was like a normal occurrence with many random strangers.
Right. In the 90s?
Yeah. You're just, and you're not always in contact with them. There's no cell phones. There's not like a real easy way to keep in contact with these people. And, you know, her mom said that it was very normal for her to be gone for 2, 3, 4 days at a time.
Yeah.
And not see her. I could not live like that.
No.
There's no goddamn way I could live like that.
No, I want a chip around my kids' necks.
Yes.
Like, literally, I mean, my daughter has one. She has a cell phone.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's like, no.
I need to know where you are at all times.
At all times. Now, learning this information about Tanya led Detective Ingram to believe that she was naive and potentially a target for violence. I mean, she's putting herself out there. A few days later, a call comes into the sheriff's office from another female stating that the man who'd committed the crime was named John Sosnowski. When they ran his name through the database, they found out that he was actually in there and was currently on probation. So Detective Ingram calls his probation officer and said he'd also received a phone call from John's girlfriend, Laverne Pavlinak, stating that she'd overheard him at a bar telling someone that he'd met Tanya Bennett and that he picked her up and had ended up murdering her and dumped her body by Vista House in the Columbia Gorge. Now they had something to work with.
Right.
I mean, that right there, that's an admittance. They can go talk to him. Now, he and his partner drove out to meet with Laverne. And Ingram tells us that she seemed like a very pleasant and cordial older lady. He says that she claimed she was afraid of John Sosnowski, and that's why it took her a couple of days to come forward, because he'd abused her and she was, you know, a battered woman. She was a little nervous around him.
For sure.
She tells Ingram that John was an alcoholic and could become violent at times during sex, saying that he also had a habit of tying rope into knots, which was kind of weird. Like, is he just walking around with rope and tying it into knots?
I thought.
Or like every rope he comes by, he just ties into a knot. Like, does she wake up and her shoelaces are all into knots? I mean, like, what a weird habit.
It's a very weird detail
and specific to add.
Yeah, we do find out why she's saying some of this stuff, and is it to be believed? We don't really know. So it could be made up, but it is a very oddly specific thing to mention.
Yes.
I don't know. It was weird.
I think it's weird too. Now, Ingram tells us that Laverne was in her late 50s while John was 40 or so. Now, he thought that it was odd that she would put up with a relationship of that nature given the age difference. Okay, here's something I have to fucking laugh about. Throughout this whole episode, they talk about Laverne as if she's 80.
I know.
She's not even 60 years old when this happens, but even like pictures of her. Okay, have you seen the whole, like, you know, the Golden Girls?
Yeah.
Okay. Have you seen when the new reboot of Sex and the City came out?
Yeah.
And they're like, these are supposed to be the same. These women are supposed to be the same age in both. One of them, they look old.
Yes.
And everyone's like, it's the hairstyle.
Yep.
So they transposed the Golden Girls hairstyles on the Sex and the City girls. And you're like, okay, it's definitely the hair because now they look old. Laverne has that. She has an old lady roller set hair.
And glasses.
And glasses. Old lady glasses.
Yes.
She is not that old.
Yeah.
But they talk about her like she is...
old, old. And, old, old. And they keep calling her grandma.
They do. Crazy. But that's the 90s. Now, when Ingram asks her whereabouts on the night that Tanya was murdered, she says that John had asked her to take him to the JB's Lounge in Wilsonville, a bar, saying that he'd gotten back home about 1:30, 2 a.m., immediately took a shower, which was unusual to her. She says that the next morning, she saw that he had a bruise on his left hip and was complaining that his hands and wrists were sore. Ingram says she seemed to be very truthful, so they ask if they can have a look around her apartment, and she's like, sure, go right ahead, look around. They had been hoping to find anything that could connect John to Tanya. In the bedroom, they do find an envelope addressed to John, and on the back was written T. Bennett, good peace, P-I-E-C-E. Okay, that doesn't really look good, but it's not...
Right.
I don't know. It's not much. And John ends up arriving home just before investigators were leaving. They identify themselves and he was very cooperative and volunteered to go down with them to be interviewed at the station. So far, like, not a whole lot of red flags, in my opinion.
No.
We hear a recording of the interview with John, and Detective Ingram is saying, do you know Tanya Ann Bennett? And John says, not to my recollection, sir. Ingram replies, we've been to your apartment and retrieved various things, one of them being a piece of paper with the name T. Bennett. Is that your printing? Assuming now he's showing him the piece of paper. John says, I cannot answer that in full honestness. So, like, you don't know your own writing?
Yeah, that, I mean, when you answer a question like that, come on.
But at the same time, if he's an alcoholic, I mean, maybe he's writing random shit down and doesn't really, I don't know. And if you look at some of my notes, it looks like four different people wrote them.
I mean, I feel like you'd have some recollection of it. You'd There's think. No way that you can't remember something like that. It just seems
odd.
And it's just a bad way to answer a question to investigators.
For real.
It makes you look guilty.
Yep.
Like, it makes you look like you're hiding something. And it's like, why answer that way? It's, I don't know.
Yeah.
John knew that Sosnowski was not going to admit to killing Tanya. I mean, none of them do.
Right.
They're not going to come out and say, yes, it was me.
Right.
So sorry.
You caught me.
Now I'm going to go to jail for the rest of my life. Like, they're not going to just admit to it. But they unfortunately did not have enough probable cause to arrest him at that time. So they had to let him go. But John had this gut feeling instead that kept telling him not to jump to conclusions. Like, there was just something that was telling him, like, I don't know if this is the right avenue. I think we need to, like, make sure to keep our eyes open and really... Like,
we need more evidence.
Yes. We need to really look at this case and make sure we have the right people and, like, you know, we're doing this correctly.
Yeah.
At this point, this is when Deputy DA Jim McIntyre was assigned to the case. This is the first time we get to meet Deputy Jim McIntyre, and he states that on February 19th, his boss walked into his office to tell him that a body had been found at the end of January. He wanted to put him on the case to get the investigation moving. Jim's boss knew that he was a bit reckless and would start directing people a certain way to get things done and to ensure that they could close this case. John had briefed Jim on the case and shared all the information he had so far. And it really struck Jim that they were kind of stuck in their investigation thus far. They really hadn't gotten very far. They didn't have much to go off of. I mean, it was a weird scenario to find her in, but that was it. That's all they had. Jim told Detective Ingram that they needed to get more information and evidence about whether John Sosnowski was involved or not. And they needed to go back and put it together. And if they couldn't, they needed to move on from him and start looking at other suspects or other potential suspects.
Right.
John tells us that he was still not convinced that John Sosnowski had any involvement in the case until he got another phone call from Laverne stating that she found some items that they may want to take a look at. She had found a purse, and inside the purse was the fly section of acid wash jeans. Basically exactly what had been missing from Tanya's pants.
Yeah.
And he had to think about it for a minute. He almost thought it was too good to be true. Like, it kind of set off alarm bells for him because this type of stuff does not happen in investigations.
Right.
Like, there's a piece of missing evidence that clearly they want, and now all of a sudden it just presents itself to them.
Right.
Like, super easily. They didn't have to, like, go search for it. It's just, oh, look, I found a purse, and it has the fly that's missing. So he kind of was like, this seems weird. Yeah. Like, this is just, there's something off about this. It was now time to interview John again. During the second interview with John Sosnowski, he states, and I quote, "I make the above statement freely and voluntarily. I have been advised of my rights, which I understand. I have seen T. Bennett at JB's truck stop on several occasions." End quote. Detective John notes that Sosnowski changes his original story and states that he had seen Tanya at JB's lounge. Originally, he never knew her.
Yeah.
Didn't know her, never saw her, had no interaction with her.
Yep.
Now the story is morphing and changing. And during the interview again, Sosnowski states, and I quote, "The last time was 21 January 1990. I was visiting with Chuck, who was playing darts. Later on in the evening, Chuck left and T. Bennett shortly after. I believe she left to go to a motel room to have fun with Chuck. Later that evening, I saw Chuck and asked him for a ride home. I believe I saw a body in the back of the car."
You believe you saw a body?
"I got into the front passenger seat. The body was wrapped in a blanket. The body was one of a white female adult. During this ride home, the dead female was in the back of his car." End quote.
I don't like it.
What? Who? Okay.
Who talks like that?
And who is going to kill someone, have the dead body in the back of a car, and offer to give someone a fucking ride home?
And then be sober cab for everybody else.
What?
Yeah.
That is like, you can't even fucking believe that story.
No, that's the most fucked up Uber.
And what? Sosnowski is just okay with that? He's okay with a dead body being back there? Like, right. Oh, he's just drop me off.
Oh. I guess I'll sit in the front then, since the back seat's taken.
Like, what the fuck? Such a horrible, horrible made-up story. Horrible.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny because Detective Ingram is literally making fun of it like we are right now.
I know.
Like, I didn't even write it down because I knew you and I would almost say exactly what he was saying.
Literally. Like, he didn't believe it.
No big deal. I'm just going to get in the front seat.
Yeah. Didn't believe a single sentence, single word that he said because he knew it was all made up.
Yeah. He's not buying it.
Jim tells us that John only raised more red flags after his interview with detectives. Like, why would someone confess to being in the presence of a dead body if they hadn't actually been with a dead body?
Right.
Yeah, that is, I didn't think of it like that, but after he said that, I'm like, exactly. Why would you want to confess to police that you have been around a dead body and didn't say anything about it?
Right. It seemed to me like he was trying to place the blame on someone else when he really had done it.
Right.
He was like, well, I was there, but like, I didn't do it.
And this even gets more weird as we get into this, because you think back to all the stuff he said and you're like, why?
And who's Chuck?
Yeah.
They just randomly bring up Chuck.
I know. It's probably not even a real person. It's kind of what I was thinking, because we never hear from him. We never hear about him. They never go interview him. We never hear anything more about this person. So I'm assuming he just wanted to throw a name out there. Who the hell knows?
Yeah.
Detective John says that the next morning he got word that the test results were back on the section of jeans they had found in the purse at Laverne's house. They were not a match for Tanya Bennett's jeans. And this, again, really confused him. Like, what is really going on here? Why would she tell us that she has this evidence? It's not Tanya's.
Who's
it? What the hell is going on here?
Yeah.
Doesn't make any sense. So John decides to go back to Laverne's house to confront her about the findings on the jeans. Laverne admits to planting that piece of evidence. Ugh. And her reasoning was that, quote, "I really wanted John Sosnowski caught. I was trying to make it easy for the police," end quote. That's also something that is so strange to me. Why would she plant evidence? This was so confusing. It was going in every different direction. I never knew where this story was going to end up because it was so all over the place.
Yeah.
It's like, is anyone telling the truth here? Is anyone saying any truths? I don't think so.
No.
Not until the end. And this was definitely a disappointment for John, but he needed to know the real truth and what really happened. So John starts chatting with a Laverne again to hopefully get the truth and records this interview with her. He asks, quote, "What happened during the evening hours of January 21st, 1990, end quote. Laverne states, quote, "The phone rang. It was John Sosnowski calling to tell me he was in trouble and to come fast and to bring something large to wrap something in," end quote. Detective John then asks, quote, "What did you take with you when you went to see John at the L&B Lounge?" Laverne states, quote, "A blue shower curtain." Again, this is a new version of what she originally stated. This is a totally different story. This is not what she originally said. So this is putting her as a potential accomplice to murder, potentially.
Right.
Because she's changing her story again, right? Now she's going to help. Now she's going to help him. She's bringing a shower curtain. It's all very strange.
It is very strange.
Ingram then asks, quote, "When you arrived there, Laverne, what did you find?" End quote. And Laverne states, quote, "A female. She was lying on her side, very prone, very quiet. And John Sosnowski came up to the window and I asked him if she's sick. He says, worse than that, she's dead." End quote. Laverne went on to say that John placed her body into the shower curtain. He then got into the vehicle and she asked, "What do we do now?" And John told her to just drive. Never.
Never.
You will never get me doing something like that for someone. I'm sorry. No. Fuck all the way off is what I will tell you.
No.
Absolutely not. I'm going to the police.
Someone, I'm going to find someone who is equally as knowledgeable as to how to hide a fucking body. I'm not just going to pick some, you know.
You're not going to pick Grandma Laverne.
No.
What the fuck?
God. She can't even. Did you see how thick her glasses were?
Oh, I know. I know.
And he trusted her to drive.
Right.
At night.
Now, Laverne goes on to say, quote, "I said, I think we need to take her to a hospital. We need to report this, John. He says, no, no, I'll go to death row. You will not do it because I will kill you and harm your family and grandchildren," end quote. Detective John is now starting to think that John Sosnowski is a real monster, and he does understand why Laverne would be afraid of him, clearly.
Yeah.
If this actually happened this way, and he was threatening her, of course you're going to do what he says. If he just killed this girl, you clearly know he's capable of killing you.
Right.
1,000%. You're way older than this girl.
Yeah.
Like, you probably can't defend yourself even as much as she might have been able to.
Yeah. Arthritis and everything.
Right. Right.
You know, decrepitness.
Laverne then states in the interview, quote, "He opened the back door on the passenger side and pulled her out. He went off into the woods and he was gone for about 15 minutes, end quote. Detective John did feel sorry for Laverne. She was really in way over her head. This was not something she wanted to get herself into. He really felt for her. And with everything that he had heard, they had reason to believe that John Sosnowski murdered Tanya Bennett, and this is when he was arrested on the charge of aggravated murder.
Deputy District Attorney McIntyre tells us that he had suggested to Ingram that he and his partner take Laverne up to the gorge to walk them through what had happened that night, retrace those steps, try to see if she can paint this picture a little bit more clearly.
Mm-hmm.
So Detective Ingram does this. He was really anxious to see if she could show them where the body had been placed. She ends up driving past the area originally where the body had been found, traveling eastbound. And then suddenly she tells them to stop the car and turn around. She tells them that, quote, "This place gives me the creeps," end quote, and then points to where the body had been located. They're showing pictures of her standing there on the side of the road pointing. And she couldn't have been more than like 10 feet off from where the body had been found. And he was like, nailed it. Here we go.
Yeah, her story must be true. It's checking out.
We're good. Here's my question, though. If he was gone for 15 minutes with that body in the woods, why the fuck could you have still seen it from the road? And how did she not still see him standing there? And or maybe what was he doing with that body?
Right. Yeah. I mean, again, we obviously know what happens at the end. But, like, it is all very strange. Yeah. It doesn't... If they were to really look at it, it didn't all add up.
No.
There was a lot of things that didn't. As much as they wanted it to add up, there was things that they forgot.
Yep.
As to, like, how she would know where the body was or, you know, why she was able to point that out. There was an easy explanation for that. And so that's what is, like... Did they just want this to be closed and they didn't really want to? I mean, they were so laser focused on John Cisnowski and they just thought, yep, he's the only one that could have done this.
Well, and with her stories, they were so detailed.
Yeah.
But they were like, there's no way that somebody's just randomly making this shit up.
Right. Or so they thought.
Right. So 5 days after this interaction of bringing her up to the, you know, dumping place, Cisnowski is arrested. And Ingram gets a phone call on his pager, at 3 a.m. Laverne wanted to speak to them again. And Ingram is immediately like, oh, crap. Like, where are we going now?
What the hell is happening
here? Why 3 in the morning? Like, are we sure that John's the one with the drinking problem, Laverne?
Right. I mean, come on. Come on.
Right. Now... Laverne is stating that Tanya was alive when she got to the bar that night to pick up John and had been, quote, play fighting with him in the parking lot.
It's like, this is the worst thing you can do to telling police officers multiple different stories. Why are you just changing your story every single time you speak to him? It's like on a day-to-day basis.
Day-to-day and not even sometimes in the middle of the fucking night.
It's so weird to me.
It's so weird.
I mean, she clearly does not know a lot or she hasn't really been, you know, a criminal before. I don't know. She just seems like she had no fucking idea what she was doing.
Right.
Like, no idea. Why would you do this? Why would you do that? Like, it's making you look really bad and not reliable.
Yeah.
Your stories are all over the fucking place and they're all different.
All different. In this story, she says that she pulls up to the bar. John tells Tanya to get in the car because it's cold outside. Suddenly, the two of them decide to have sex. What? Laverne is driving, his girlfriend, for reference.
Right.
They decide John and Tanya are going to go do it. So they get to Crown Point and they get out of the car. Laverne remains in the car because she is loyal.
Yeah.
And just, I'll just wait here. You two kids have your fun. And when you come back, I'll have some cookies baked up or some shit. What do grandmas do? I don't know.
Right? It's
fucking weird.
It's very strange.
She says that after a short time, which, sorry to hear that, John comes back to the car and grabs a rope from the trunk, saying that he wanted to tie her up for, quote, more of a thrill this way, end quote. She gets out of the car and walks back with John and sees Tanya laying in a doorway laughing. John tells Laverne to put the rope around Tanya's neck. Ingram is listening to the story, right? It's 3 in the morning when he's hearing this story. And he's thinking, how the hell could this grandma place a rope around a young lady's neck and draw it tight? Like, could not process this story and how it possibly happened the way that it's being told.
Because it does not happen.
Like, it sounds really fucking weird. Also, why is this the exact story that we just talked about in our last episode?
Oh, shit. That's right.
The exact same fucking story.
Oh, my God. I never even thought about that. It's been so long since we did that episode.
Yeah, there's just no meth involved this time. Well, right. At least we don't know about any meth.
Holy shit. It's an epiphany. Didn't even think about that.
Yeah.
Totally true.
Yeah. Laverne goes on to say that John then had sex with Tanya while Laverne stood there with her eyes shut. And he kept telling her to hang on to the rope. So Laverne is holding on to the rope while John is having sex with Tanya with the rope around her neck. Laverne says she must have tightened it as she was hanging on. Then, all of a sudden, John is also punching Tanya in the face, and then she just goes limp, and she had died. Detective Ingram says that Laverne's tone and her emotion and all of these facts made them really feel like this was the actual story. Like, she was finally telling them the truth and not trying to make light of it. She was giving them the information.
I don't know if I'd believe her. Honestly, they said that every time. Yeah. Detective Ingram said that every time. He's like, I believed her. She was so believable. And it's like, but she changed her story three times.
Big time.
Yes, like it wasn't completely. Like,
well, at first you said you were going to the bar, but you actually stopped at the grocery store. It wasn't something like that. It was literally the entire story from beginning to end
was different. Changed. I mean, I get as a detective, like, obviously you feel like this lady clearly had something to do with it. Why would she insert herself into this investigation and have all these details, right? And not have been involved in some way. But I would still be like, this doesn't make any fucking sense.
It doesn't.
Nothing does.
No. So Laverne eventually states that she felt that Tanya had died at her hands. Now, of course, Detective Ingram knows that they'd have to arrest Laverne at some point, but something felt off to him. You know, was there this evil side to this grandmother, or was John such a dark influence on her that he kind of, you know, almost made her do it without making her do it? Again, a Dena Reilly situation. And of course, the next day, Deputy District Attorney McIntyre is like, well, did you arrest her? And Ingram's like, well, no. And he's like, you gotta go arrest her. He's like, she just admitted to you have to go arrest her. Damn it, John. What are you doing?
He was still, even retelling the story now, he was frustrated. He's like, what the hell are you doing? She just confessed to murder. Go arrest her. Like, what?
And it's not like it was self-defense.
Right.
Where you could be like, I feel bad arresting her because this guy was beating the shit out of her and yeah. She fucking killed him. No, this was no. How about no?
What a big fat no.
Oh. So Detective Ingram goes and arrests Laverne. He says he's supposed to cuff her, put her in the back seat. He doesn't cuff her. He doesn't want to cuff her. Fucking A. He says he just still felt so sorry for her. And when they got to the jail and he's getting ready to walk her to her holding cell, she stops and gives him a hug. And he honestly, during this interview, is overcome with emotion and has to like stop for a moment. And like tearing up.
Yeah.
Reliving this whole thing. And they show a picture of Laverne's mugshot.
Mm-hmm. It's sad.
Golden Girls.
And it's sad. I mean, you can tell she's crying and like it just, it is sad. I can imagine, because he even stated that it felt like he was putting his grandmother in jail. I would probably feel the same way because it's so out of left field. Grandmothers are not the first people that are killers.
Yeah.
They're just not, yeah. You know, and her whole situation being with someone who was 40 was also strange in itself. And
yeah,
they just did not seem like a match at all.
At all.
Like, the farthest thing from a match? I don't know. But yeah, I can understand why he would feel bad because she looked very sad. And I was so confused. I was so confused.
You know what I was more confused about? I would have been so offended that he kept referring to me as grandma.
I know.
Even if I was a grandma, man, you're a fucking police officer. I ain't your grandma.
Right.
I ain't that old. But I digress. District Attorney McIntyre says he felt that Laverne had all of the investigators charmed and under her control without them knowing it. He had empathy for the position that she was in, but she still admitted to killing Tanya Bennett. Like, she's right. A fucking murderer.
Right.
And everybody feels sorry for her for doing it. It's like, that's like master manipulation right there, right? Right. It's now 1991, and they're getting ready for trial. And again, Laverne changes her story and is now claiming that her entire confession was a fabricated lie. None of it had happened. She says that she had done all of this, all of these storytellings, all of the admissions of guilt, all to get John arrested and out of her life. And District Attorney McIntyre wasn't surprised at this at all. You're now on trial. Of course you're going to recant,
mm-hmm.
You know, and change your entire story.
Right.
This is not new.
Right.
Detective Ingram says that he went to the DA's office and said that he still really felt like they were missing something big. Like he couldn't figure it out about this. But the trial moved along. And during closing arguments, Her lawyer gave all the reasons on why she'd made up this entire confession. But during his closing argument, McIntyre simply plays her taped confession. He doesn't say a word. Mm-hmm. He just hits play and lets the entire court hear her say, "I feel like it's my fault."
That's a pretty fucking boss move to do. I mean, that is fucking cool. Like,
big dick energy here.
Seriously.
With McIntyre. Like,
I wish I could do something that cool.
Oh,
that's fucking cool.
Super cool. I wouldn't be able to keep my mouth shut long enough to do something
like
that.
I know.
I'd but be just like, let me tell you why I'm right.
Like, let Laverne tell you why she's guilty.
Yeah.
Like, I don't have to.
Yep.
Laverne can tell you. Yep. It's like, it's so fucking cool.
It's so cool.
So cool.
I know. Why am I like fangirling over this guy right now?
I know.
And that was it. She was convicted by 12 for murder. Now, John Sosnowski goes in and enters a plea of no contest. So he's not contesting any of the information, but he's also not going to go on trial.
Yeah.
Because he's up for the death penalty and he's not interested. We now jump forward to 1994. So 3 years later, and we see on screen District Attorney McIntyre reading a letter to us. And he says, quote, "I killed Ms. Bennett. Cut the buttons off her jeans, placed her face down with pants around her ankles. A man and a woman got blamed for it. She was my first, and I thought I would not do it again, but I was wrong." And that's how the first episode ends, you guys, which is why we could not fucking end it like this.
Right.
So, Kenzie, tell us how episode 2 starts off.
Okay, so we meet Phil Stanford, who's actually a journalist. And on April 29th, 1994, he was a writer on the crime team at the Oregonian, which was a successful newspaper company in Portland at the time. And it was early afternoon. The editor came by and handed him a letter. "It seems crazy, but you may want to take a look at it," he said. The printing in the note was irregular. There was lots of like capital letters, lowercase letters, and it was really violent in nature the way it was written. But there were...
just described my note-taking for this podcast. Look, lowercase, uppercase, some of it's violent. There's a lot
that is
of...
true.
Some of this is really scratched out, irritatingly.
Yes.
Shit. Maybe I should not be holding on to these notes.
Right? But there was one thing that really stood out in these letters, and that was smiley faces. There was these small smiley faces all over these letters. Now, Phil started reading some of this letter. Quote, "I would like to tell my story. I have always wanted to be noticed, so I started something I don't know how to stop. On or around January 20th, 1990, I picked up Sonia Bennett and took her home. I raped her and beat her real bad. Her face was all broke up. Then I ended her life," end quote. Phil noticed that this writer was referring to Tanya Bennett, but accidentally called her Sonia Bennett in the letter. So that was something that kind of stood out to him.
Although I wouldn't, if it was somebody who had like slept with her and then killed her and didn't know her like outside of that one interaction, I could see how Tanya and Sonia would sound a lot alike.
Right. Yeah. And at this point, it had been quite a few years since it happened. So,
right.
I mean, it seemed to be not a premeditated murder.
No.
It just happened. So he had just met her. I can see that.
Yeah.
Now, Phil says that working for a newspaper company, they tend to get, you know, prank calls, letters, and, you know, prank tips from people just wanting their 5 minutes of fame. But if this letter was to be believed, there were two people in prison that were innocent.
Yeah.
Our deputy DA, Jim McIntyre, comes back and said the letters that had been received by the newspaper were sent to the courthouse. The DA wanted Jim to take a look at it. His initial reaction to the letter was the writer was looking for attention. He did not believe it at all. He had no doubt in his mind that the two people that were in prison for Tanya Bennett's murder were the actual killers.
Right.
Now we see Jim reading some of the letter as well. Quote, "I am a good person at times. I always wanted to be liked. I want to know that it was my crime, so I tied a half-inch soft white rope, cut on one end, and burned on the other around her neck," end quote. Jim does state that there had been a rope, but one of the ends had not been burned. So that was an inaccurate statement.
Yep.
And there was, in the letter in its entirety, a lot of accuracies and inaccuracies. So to him, that led him to think there's no way this can be real. If the real killer wouldn't give inaccurate statements, they would know everything about it, right?
Well, especially if they're wanting to get attention for it. Yeah. Why would you mess up?
Exactly. Exactly.
Because that would have had to have been intentional.
Right. Continuing with the letter, quote, her face was all broke up. Then I ended her life by pushing my fist into her throat, end quote. Jim also claims that this statement does not fit with the autopsy report. There was no doubt that he had the correct people in prison. Both Laverne and John had implicated themselves in Tanya's murder. He thought this letter was nothing more than a sick joke. Didn't believe it at all.
Yeah.
Now, Detective John Ingram recalls getting a phone call from Jim informing him of this letter that they had received. All he could think of was, wow, was that nagging feeling I had valid throughout this whole case in the beginning? Was I onto something? Did I know that something didn't feel right about this?
Right.
And this had him reeling. He was second guessing himself left and right now. I mean, he was really worried at this point. So right. Jim and Detective John were on completely different platforms here.
Yeah.
Jim didn't believe it.
Like Detective John had some mommy issues that Laverne was somehow yes, filling.
For sure. For sure. Jim goes on to say that as far as he was concerned, this case had been over with 3 years prior, but the DA thought the letters could be a big problem for them. They were going to need to do something because they knew that Phil Stanford, our journalist, was going to write about it. Ignoring these letters was not an option. Jim tells us that Phil Stanford was known as a journalist who would constantly write about issues in the public sector, usually law enforcement or politics. He was the type of journalist who would say anything to gain more readers. You can tell by the way that he's talking about him.
Yeah.
He doesn't like him. Yeah. They were never friends. They were arch enemies, I'm sure.
Yeah. Thorn in his side.
Yes. And this makes Phil laugh. I mean, because to him, I mean, he had no problems with Jim, but he was always the one that was really nagging for more information and always kind of making Jim out to be a bad guy in the news media,
yeah.
in the newspaper. Phil knew people in law enforcement thought he was a pain in their ass. Phil, on the other hand, took it as a compliment. The person who wrote these letters claimed to have killed 5 people, but Phil was going to need more evidence. So he started going down the list of the victims that were listed in the letters.
This is like a thing of the old days.
Yeah.
When journalists actually fact check their shit before yep. they print it.
Doesn't happen anymore.
This was real news.
Yeah. This was the news you could rely on.
Yes.
Now back to the letter. Quote, one day in California, I picked up a girl named Claudia. On the way out of LA, my mind went wild with the thought of a sex slave. And when I stopped at the rest area, I took her. A hooker became my next victim. I placed her body in the dirt and stepped on her throat. This triggered something in me. It was getting easy, real easy, end quote. Phil started to make calls to the other jurisdictions listed in the letters, and each detective he talked to confirmed that one of the women listed were women they had recovered mm-hmm. or that they were looking for. Some of the detectives also mentioned that the writer had information that had not been released to the public on some of these other cases.
Right.
So he had said stuff that no one knew because they didn't release it. So only the killer would know. So now it's starting to be believed that this yeah. person could actually have killed her. Now, 4 of the 5 murders had checked out. He knew it was time for him to go back and look at Tanya Bennett's files. It didn't take long for him to realize that this was a really shaky case. And it all starts with Laverne's taped confession. The first confession where Laverne states she picked up John and Tanya at that point was already dead before she even got there. So that would make Laverne not a part of the crime because Tanya was already dead at that point.
Right. She was just accomplice to the concealment of the crime.
Yes. Right. And Laverne's biggest problem was her story kept changing, and every time that she gave them a story, it always turned out to be false. So that should be a big red flag for detectives, right? She's not believable. Detective John says that the more complicated the case got, the heavier the uneasiness was for him. When Laverne was able to point to the exact spot where Tanya had been found, that is what made him think she was telling them the truth all along.
But Phil Stanford, our journalist, points out that there was no forensic evidence that could prove that John and Laverne had in fact killed Tanya Bennett. So he calls McIntyre for a quote. McIntyre, not super eager to answer him. Doesn't really like him. Doesn't really want to be there.
Not at all.
But he wasn't in a position to tell this detective that he believed that they were wrong. Because at this point, I mean, he's got some information, but not a whole lot on the Tanya Bennett part.
Exactly.
So he went directly to the source, visiting John and Laverne in prison. He comes up to Laverne, who is now in her mid-60s. He says, a frail little grandma.
Every single one of them is referring to her as grandma.
But frail.
Yeah.
My mother is almost 70. And not once would frail or little be something that I would use as description.
And I think the reason he said that is because prison does take a toll on you.
Well, yes. You're right.
You know, she's not a criminal.
Yeah.
So her being there probably did make her really frail. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think, and it ages you way faster. Right. You know, like people in prison look shitty.
Some.
Yeah. Like, yeah, some of them. Not some all of them. Some
get super jacked.
Yeah.
Remember that guy that was like going all over like social media?
Oh my God.
You know exactly who I'm talking about with like the bright blue eyes where you're like, I don't care. He
had tattoos on his face, I think.
Like, I don't care what you did. He became like this hot, this poster boy for prison men.
Yes, he did.
I don't know how we went from Laverne to him.
I totally forgot about him. That popped into my head. That's so funny.
And you saw his face when I said it, didn't you?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Know who you're talking about. Yeah. For sure.
So when Phil asks Laverne why she did it, why she'd confessed, she claimed that Sosnowski had been abusive to her and that she wanted to get him out of her house. She claimed that it had all snowballed on her, and this was a term that she had used several times in this conversation, snowballed. But then he asks her, how did she know the spot that the body had been dumped? I mean, they had pictures of her standing on the side of the road, pointing out almost directly to where the body had been found. And she explains, well, the newspapers had done a picture of it, kind of, not like the picture of the body, but like the view from the road.
Yeah.
And there was it like a big tree that was like down? Or yeah, something it looked like that. Right there?
Yep.
So, yeah. So it had been like knocked down. So you're looking at like, you know, a tree like horizontal on the ground. And she's like standing there. So like, obviously, she's a female, right?
Yeah.
She's not going to know north, south, east, or west, but she's going to know a landmark, like a downed tree.
Right.
In this spot and be like, yep, right over there.
And how didn't the detectives think of that?
They show a picture of it.
I know. It's so... I just think that's bad detective work. Like, they missed something. How did they not realize they already shared that information with the media?
But I think the problem was that she was confessing.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the problem.
So she was confessing.
So they were like, well, fuck it. Like, this is what it is.
Yeah. She must have done it.
She must have done it. And Phil says that, again, he felt sorry for her. She wasn't angry, sad, or anything like that, but she just sort of looked beaten down. John, on the other hand, was beside himself with anger. He says that Laverne had framed him and that he pled no contest just to escape execution. Phil felt that they were both completely innocent, and he told his bosses that he wanted to write a series on this letter and this situation.
Mm-hmm.
So he's thinking about how to start writing about this and how to get readers' attention and what to call this guy. And he decides to call him the Happy Face Killer because of all of the happy faces printed all over the letter that he sent in. District Attorney McIntyre says that, you know, he maybe glanced at these articles as they were being published, but he makes it really well known that he never read a single one of Phil Stanford's columns line for line.
Right.
Not interested.
He did not want to give his articles attention.
No.
At all.
He literally was like, this is smut and I'm not interested.
Yeah.
Phil Stanford says that he thought for sure the DA would see how he'd kind of destroyed their case against John and Laverne with these articles. I mean, there's so much proof in here that it can't possibly just be them. You can't have just gone off of confession tapes. But it didn't help because no one was looking at him.
Right.
McIntyre says that the state didn't go after Laverne. She said herself that she'd killed Tanya Bennett. John was in prison because he pled no contest. He felt that the journalist fashioned himself as this great crime writer and detective, all on his way to a Pulitzer Prize, and he thought that it was complete nonsense. Phil was convinced that the real killer was still out there. In 1995, McIntyre hadn't heard anything on this case in well over a year, and then all of a sudden, this bomb goes off. This alleged murderer, Keith Jesperson, in an exclusive interview with Channel 2 News, confesses to being the Happy Face Killer. Now, Keith Jesperson was in custody in Clark County, Washington, pending trial on the murder of his girlfriend. Now, he seemed pretty proud of it, you know, to be the Happy Face Killer. I mean, he was talking about it.
Oh, yeah. Like, anyone and everyone. Yep.
Right. And we hear a quick recording that says, quote, "There is no doubt in my mind. I am him. I am the Happy Face Killer," end quote. Which is weird to me because it's like, if you fucking wrote it, why would there be a doubt in your mind? But
again, I don't know. Yeah, there's just weird statements he made. It's like, how do you not remember writing multiple letters and sending right. them in so people know that you did it? Like,
yeah.
What?
Well, and McIntyre didn't fully believe it because of how much attention he seemed to just be seeking yeah. in this whole thing. We hear a reporter on the news talking in the background as different things are flashing across the screen that says that he had confessed to as many as 8 murders. McIntyre says Jesperson was guilty of one murder for sure, his girlfriend, but investigations were still being done in the other states, checking to see if they could find evidence to corroborate his statements. The year before, they'd found DNA on the letter stamp that had been sent to the Oregonian. And this established a profile.
Mm-hmm.
But again, if you don't have anything to compare it to, you just have a profile. So the DNA was checked against Jesperson's, and it did match as him being the author of the Happy Face Killer letter.
Oh, shit is getting real.
But does that mean that he's responsible for Tanya's murder? He could have easily just written about it, right?
Sure.
Just because he wrote the letter doesn't mean he actually did it. On September 25th, McIntyre is contacted by Jesperson's attorney. The intent was to admit to Tanya's murder, but McIntyre was a bit dismissive about it, right? He already had his 2 people in jail. He wasn't super excited about hearing about this guy. But the lawyer was adamant that he needed to listen to him. And McIntyre did know this attorney personally, so he's like, all right, fine, fuck it. Let's get together. We'll talk about yeah. it. And that's when he began to think, shit, this could be a problem.
Yeah.
It could be that the 2 people in prison didn't actually do this.
We get to hear the taped interview with Keith Jesperson. He states, and I quote, "I went out for a walk and I decided I'd go out and play some pool. I walked into the tavern and this gal walked over and gave me a hug like I was somebody she knew. I just thought she was over friendly, but she actually gave hugs to about everybody there," end quote. Jim noticed that Keith's description of how Tanya acted in the bar was consistent with all the reports they had heard about her behavior. She always assumed the best out of people and that everyone was a nice person.
See, this is why I'm a pessimistic bitch. Because people are not nice, and I would never right. just walk up to some strange and give him a hug.
Right. No. No, thank you. Ick. No. They probably stink.
Well, that's no. exactly what I was thinking. I was like, who knows where he's been or right. how long he's been walking?
Exactly. Now, Jesperson continues, quote, "I invited her to dinner, but I was conscious that I didn't have enough money, so I told her I could go back to the house and get a $20 bill out of the dresser," end quote.
Where's he taking her for dinner that he only needs $20?
Yeah, it seems very cheap. Strange. I don't know. Did they not have credit cards then? Were credit cards? They were ahead of
a thing.
It's like you didn't have a credit card.
You couldn't write a check.
It's Keith. Weird.
Everybody had checks.
Everyone had checks then.
And everybody wrote checks.
Jim tells us that Keith then said that he drove Tanya back to his house. When they got inside, Tanya was acting flirtatious and was really showing her attraction to him. Now back to the taped interview, Jesperson said, quote, "I kissed her on the neck, went from there, but something just didn't seem right. I don't know if it was clicking for her or not. She was complaining she wasn't excited yet, and she made a comment something like, 'I'm not getting there. Why don't you get it over with?'"
Ouch.
That's rough. "That pissed me off. I tagged her with my right arm. I just lost my cool, and I struck her in the side of the face, and I never stopped striking her until she was laying there," end quote. To Jim, it was very clear that he had no emotion or remorse towards Tanya. He didn't really care.
Yeah.
He didn't care what he did because he didn't know her.
We didn't know her.
Had no connection to her prior to meeting her a few hours earlier.
Right.
That was about it. Jesperson goes on to say, quote, she said things that my wife used to tell me when we were having sex and it just brought back memories. I don't think I was all there at that time. End quote.
Boo fucking who?
Yeah. Who the fuck cares?
Okay. So you suck in bed, Keith. Get
the fuck exactly. Over it. Exactly. Jim thinks the way he told his story was not surprising. It was good in detail, but was it really a memory or was it just made up? He couldn't right. really tell.
Yeah.
Again, he didn't know much about Jesperson at this point in time, so it was really hard for him to make a...
Judgment
on him, yeah. And so he wasn't really sure.
Well, and even though it was pretty detailed, fucking Laverne's story was super detailed too.
Right.
All of them.
Exactly. Jesperson continues, quote, I was thinking of the fingernails I left on the buttons, so I took the buttons off her jeans. I take off in the car, and I go looking for a place I can dump her body. I noticed a bunch of people parked around the vista, maybe 3 or 4 cars. I finally figured I'd just keep on going down the hill until I found a place. At that time, I was really getting kind of panicky, and I saw a big tree on the right, and then I stopped in front of it. I grabbed her and dragged her down the hill. At this point, Jim was still waiting to hear Keith say something that only the killer would know. So something that was not released in the news media, something that like no one else would know.
Right.
And he still hasn't said anything yet. Yeah. So nothing yet that's really stood out. Now back to the taped interview. The interviewer asks, quote, you've talked about a purse, end quote. And Jesperson says, quote, yes, I got rid of her purse the next following morning, end quote. Mind you, her purse or personal belongings were never found by authorities.
Which is why they had to do that sketch of her face to figure out who she was. She was a Jane Doe.
Exactly. Exactly. So this could be that piece of evidence. If he is able to find her purse or ID, this would make Jim realize that he was the actual killer.
Right.
Jesperson goes on to say, quote, I drove back out of there, followed generally the same path across the river, and I pulled over to a wide spot. I took the purse and I tossed the contents and the purse out over the area. Purse probably went 40 feet down off the bank. End quote. Jim says that when they head out to hopefully find her missing items, they took an unmarked panel van, which had himself, Jesperson, Jesperson's lawyer, Jim's detective, and 3 other armed sheriff's deputies. They also had an unmarked patrol car that followed behind the van. They got up near where Tanya had been placed, and Jesperson asked them to stop the van. He walked around the area for a while, and then he pointed and said, I think it was in this area right around here, but I'm not sure. Jim and his detective knew that this was not the right location where Tanya had been placed. It was now down to just the purse. Would he be able to positively identify where he tossed her purse? They kept heading southbound up the Sandy River to a point where he stated, this is where I threw the purse. And he pointed out down an embankment. By this time, this embankment was completely overgrown with blackberries. They couldn't see shit at all.
Well, it's been fucking years.
It's been years. And the search of the embankment took place around October 7th, and they searched the entire day and didn't find anything. Jim went into the DA's office to tell him that they had run into another dead end and things were falling apart with this case against Jesperson. About a week later, he got a page from a detective who told him that he had Tanya Bennett's Oregon ID card in his hand. Holy
shit. I know, right?
Shit.
He was like, are you kidding me?
Are you sitting down? This is some big shit.
Right.
He said he had explorer scouts go back to the embankment and had them cut the blackberry bushes all the way down to the earth, and this is when they found her ID. This meant that Keith Jesperson had to be the killer. Jim was in complete shock.
Yeah.
When Detective John found out, he was super disappointed in himself after finding out that Jesperson was the killer. It was horrible to think that 7 other women had died because they had not caught him sooner.
Yeah.
And it completely ruined Laverne's life, and he really felt bad for John. I mean, it's kind of on their back that this...
Yeah.
They're in jail because of them, yeah. You know? John Cisnoski wasn't the greatest guy and had history of alcohol abuse, but that did not make him a killer.
Right.
Jim said it was horrible. He knew that 2 innocent people were in jail and now they needed to try and get them released from jail.
Yeah, because you can't just be like, oh, They didn't do it.
So I thought that was a little confusing because I thought they would be automatically released because they found...
Except that she still confessed.
It's so strange.
It is strange.
Jim never felt like he owed it to Laverne, though. This actually is where his anger came from towards Laverne. He was angry with her.
I mean, I don't blame her. Yeah. I mean, I don't blame him.
I know.
I blame her.
Right. If Laverne hadn't sidetracked this investigation in 1990, maybe those other women wouldn't have been killed. I get it.
Totally.
But you can't be putting all the blame on Laverne.
I
mean, you could have looked elsewhere as well. You could have sought other leads. You could have dug a little bit deeper because you already knew all of her stories were fucking made up.
Yeah.
You already didn't really trust her.
Yeah.
Okay. So like, yes, Laverne should not have done that. And I think it snowballed for her. I think she didn't know what to do. You know what I mean? I do believe that.
And she had never watched. I don't think true crime existed back
then. Oh, yeah. No, I don't think that was a thing at all. And definitely not something she partaked in and or watched.
No.
But like to put all the blame on her, I'm like, come on. Yeah. You were also a part of this as well. Mostly Laverne. But, you know, take a little bit of accountability for that, too. We get some on-screen text that states Laverne Pavlinak and John Sosnowski were released in November of 1995 after being incarcerated for more than 5 years. Our journalist, Phil, felt really good about this one. Yeah. Two people got out of prison and he likes to think he had something to do with it. For sure. We get some more on-screen text that states Keith Jesperson was convicted on multiple counts of murder. He will never be released from prison. John ends our documentary today with basically just saying he wishes he could go back in time and do it all over again.
Yeah.
He feels so much sadness over this. I mean, he really does feel guilty. You can see it. I mean, he has all the emotions on his face even today. I'm sure it's something that he's going to carry the rest of his life. It's going to be hard for him to get over it.
For him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's going to be tough. So I felt a little bit bad for John. Jim's kind of an asshole. I don't know.
I like Jim.
He says it how it is.
Yeah.
I like John better. My personal
opinion.
One's
a district attorney and one is an investigator. Right. So they're on two different sides, right?
Yes, they are.
Yeah.
But that's the story on the Happy Face Killer.
Yeah. So that was pretty fucking weird.
Yeah, it was. It was all over the goddamn place. I never knew what was going to happen next. Which I like.
Me too.
I like the episodes that are like that because I feel like it keeps the suspense up. Like it's not like automatically, oh, it's the husband. Oh, it's the wife. Or, oh, you know, you already know what it's going to be.
Yeah.
It was a little bit more suspenseful.
Wife. Yeah. It's always the husband.
Sometimes.
It's always sometimes. The
mostly the husband. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, you guys, for tuning in this week. I know that we kept you waiting for
so long.
I'm so sorry. But we're so glad to be back. We liked the series so much that our next episode is also going to be from Catching Killers, but this time it's going to be on the Green River Killer. In the meantime, if you have any requests for documentaries that you'd like us to cover on the show, you can send that to our email, requests@sheercrimepodcast.com. You can join us on Facebook in the Sheer Crime Podcast discussion group. We probably have the most interaction on there, I would think. People post stuff all the time.
For sure.
Yeah.
Out of all of our social media, for sure.
Yeah, it's fun. On Instagram, we're sheer_crime_podcast, Twitter @sheercrimepod, and on TikTok @SheerCrimePodcast. That's all we have for you today. So as always, stay safe, stay sane, and remember, never run with scissors. Bye, guys.
See ya.